You think we're simple, you think we're not bright. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 21 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Nothing Basic About It, from a conversation I had with Michael Neff, Professor of Crop Biotechnology in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences at Washington State University. His lab investigates how plants work by altering gene expression, specifically how plants use light. I was interested in talking with Neff about the new technology called CRISPR-Cas9, a gene editing tool that is touted by some as the successor to transgenics. Not only that, the technology has the very real potential to cure human diseases of a genetic origin and even alter genomes in utero. For wheat farmers, CRISPR-Cas9 allows researchers to improve the crop by silencing genes without inserting foreign genes. Chinese scientists have already proven the concept, creating a powdery mildew-resistant wheat by silencing three genes. And unlike transgenics, there's no way to detect any difference in a plant between CRISPR-Cas9 editing and naturally occurring mutations, making the anti-GMO crowd very nervous. So what is CRISPR-Cas9 exactly, besides, as Neff puts it, a game changer? First, it's important to point out that CRISPR, without the Cas9, came first, back in the 1980s. I promise not to get too scientific here, but I do want to read you what this made-up word CRISPR stands for. Clustered, regularly interspaced, short, palindromic repeats. Palindromic is defined as sequences that repeat and read the same backward and forward. Part of the immune system of bacteria, CRISPR captures an invader's DNA and integrates it into its own genome in order to fend off future attacks. The Cas9 part of CRISPR came later, around 2012. Essentially, it allows scientists to reprogram an enzyme produced by the CRISPR system, the enzyme is called Cas9, to enable the editing of genes not only in bacteria, but in plants, animals, and people too. The wheat industry is particularly interested in the technology, curious to see if the grain crop, which now has no commercially available transgenic varieties, can leapfrog over the older science into something more palatable to the anti-GMO crowd, both here and abroad. I'll get into that part of our discussion, but Neff also wanted to use the opportunity of our interview to advocate for basic research. For the record, applied research is research that, in the case of agriculture, can be put to work out in the field. Breeding wheat is applied research. Basic science, also called pure research, however, is often driven by nothing more than satisfying a scientist's curiosity. The investigation that led to the CRISPR-Cas9 breakthrough started out as that curiosity, and Neff said, is an ideal example of basic research that paid off.
In the 70s, people were studying how come some bacteria got the flu, got sick, got a virus, and other bacteria didn't. And some people found out about this and said, oh my gosh, look at the waste of taxpayer dollars. Why are we paying any money at all for people to discover why some bacteria that get us sick get sick and other bacteria don't? And what they discovered were those genes and those proteins that cut those specific sequences of DNA. That discovery has completely changed genetics, genomics, and medicine. Because of those discoveries, we can do now things that we never could have done before. And when we talk about genome editing, the group that has discovered CRISPR-Cas genome editing, was studying how some bacteria get the flu and others do not. Again, in both of those cases, it were people that were just inherently curious about how an organism works, and they made a discovery, and they had no idea until they started to actually figure out how this all works, that they could co-opt that tool for a completely different purpose in biology. Fundamental basic science is incredibly important. You know, there was a scientist a long time ago in the mid-1800s who was working on breeding peas. And he was very interested in the different traits that peas had. And that was the beginning of modern genetics. That was Mendel. And all he was doing was just trying to figure out how peas worked. So it's very important to recognize that we need to be thinking about and we need to be investing in fundamental basic research because we have no idea what we could uncover from that.
I'm not saying I understand everything Neff is talking about. He has a PhD in a very technical discipline, and I don't. But even if I don't recognize every word, Neff's enthusiasm doesn't need translation. Although CRISPR-Cas9 is getting all the publicity, it's not the only editing technique out there. Neff said there's another technology referred to as TALENs, and also one called zinc finger nucleases. But they all operate similarly.
In each of these cases, what you have is either a piece of DNA or RNA or a protein that targets a very, very specific DNA sequence in the genome. And then it cuts the DNA right in that region. The cells in the plant or the animal or the bacteria, because genome editing is used in many different organisms. In fact, at WSU, it's being done with insects and animals and plants. In each case, once that DNA has been broken or cut, the cell repairs that break. Sometimes when the cell repairs that break, it makes a mistake. And that introduces a mutation, the same kind of mutation that you would just find out in the world if a plant is exposed to too bright a sunlight or to some sort of a chemical, or those mutations just happen whenever cells divide. And so we have this targeting mechanism that identifies a specific stretch of DNA, and then the DNA gets cut, the DNA gets repaired, and then we go in and we screen those populations of these gene editing populations for individuals that have had mutations in our gene of the type of mutation we're looking for, whether it makes the gene no longer functional, or changes the gene's function, or changes one, you know, amino acid or the shape of the protein that that gene encodes.
So are you saying you don't know exactly what's going to happen when you make these edits?
So you don't know what's going to happen when you make the edits, though there are ways to set up the editing so that you can favor a particular type of event. And then what we do is we go in and we identify the region. We already know the region that we're targeting, so we know that gene sequence. We can pull that gene out or amplify up that gene from those individuals and sequence it and see what kind of change we make. The nice thing about this technology is we can make 100 plants with changes in them, and then we screen through those 100 plants until we find the change that we're actually looking for. So once we do that characterization, then we do know exactly what happened, but we didn't know that it was going to exactly be that. We needed to screen enough individuals to find what we were looking for.
How is that different from mutagenesis? Because in mutagenesis, you're exposing the seed to a chemical which changes the genetic makeup. The scientists then go back and look and see what they have. Is that similar?
It's very similar. So in the case of mutagenesis, however, you are causing mutations throughout the entire genome. You have to do it at a high enough rate that you'll actually see one in the gene that you're targeting. And then you have to do a series of genetic backcrosses to clean up or remove all of the other mutations and just keep the one that you want. We use this technique actually also in our lab where we make these populations or other people make these mutagenic populations in plants, and then we either sequence those plants or we screen the plants by different mechanisms to look for mutations in the genes that we're interested in. Those are non-transgenic. Mutagenesis used in breeding is non-transgenic. Those are non-GMO. Now, in the case of gene editing, what we're making is just one mutation in one gene without any other mutations in the rest of the genome.
So it's more like a rifle than a shotgun.
Yes, exactly. It's more like a rifle than a shotgun, a very accurate rifle.
Where are universities with regard to using these technologies versus private companies?
We can use all of those techniques to ask how an organism works. But we cannot sell something that we've developed with those technologies if those technologies' intellectual property rights are owned by one of those large companies. So for fundamental research, we can use these techniques, no problem. And we can discover new ideas like making a bigger seed or making something flower earlier or make something larger or smaller. But then we would need to work with a company that has what we call the freedom to operate, the patent portfolio, to actually develop that product. A company is only going to work on a product that is going to be profitable to them. The amount of money that goes into developing and licensing a transgene in a crop could be on the order of, you know, tens or even $100 million. That money, those sorts of companies have, but it's going to take them between 15 and 30 years to recover the investment that goes in. So they're going to work on products that are going to be used in large-scale agricultural systems that are covering many, many acres, which is why the early traits that were developed were in corn and soybean and cotton that are grown in large amounts of acreage in the Midwest and the southern Midwest United States. Universities could work on more niche problems, and sometimes they do, often through breeding, but you could. The example that I like to give is that Monsanto is not going to, or any of those companies, is not going to put a lot of money into solving, through transgenics, a wireworm resistance or Hessian fly resistance problem in wheat if that's only a problem in one or two counties in the state of Washington, compared to corn or soybean, which is grown over, you know, 10 states or more in the middle of the country.
So let's take another example, snow mold resistance.
Yeah, snow mold, yeah.
I would imagine that snow mold resistance can probably be solved through some kind of transgenics. But essentially what you're saying is it never will be because it's not a big enough problem.
It won't likely be in the current intellectual property and patent arena. Now, patents last 20 years. And then they're open for the public to use. Patents are there so that a company that has a great idea or purchases a great idea has one up on their competitors for a defined amount of time, and then that technology is available to everyone. Now, eventually, a lot of these enabling technologies for making transgenic plants, as well as some of the sequences, gene sequences that we use in that process, will come off patent. Then a university could develop a trait like that as a transgenic trait, as long as it can be used by the farmers, and the farmers will be able to sell that commodity that they're growing.
Now, we keep talking about transgenics here, and I keep thinking of transgenics as the traditional corn, soybean, cotton model that Monsanto has become known for as Monsatan and Frankenfood, etc. But now these new technologies are different. I mean, are the transgenics, the ones that we think of that were introduced in 1996, are they going out the door, and are we going to have these new technologies, the Talens, the CRISPR-Cas9, are they going to replace what we think of as transgenics today?
I don't think that they'll replace what we think of as transgenics today. I think that what we will have is an additional set of tools to work with that we did not have before. So there are certain situations where gene editing can generate the type of trait that we're looking for. Gene editing has been used to make a non-transgenic Roundup-ready flax. That was done by a small company in Southern California. This was a very precise approach that they used to make very specific mutations in a very specific gene that any other mutation in that gene would not work. Now, they chose that approach because they could make something that's Roundup resistant and is not transgenic. I think that if there was no problem with transgenics and they had all the intellectual property, they probably would have just gone the transgenic route. If it was Monsanto, they would have just said, okay, we'll go ahead and do the transgenic route, but we're not going to do it in flax because we're not going to sell enough flax seeds. So maybe we wouldn't. So these guys did it in a way where they don't have to go through the regulatory steps to get this approved. They still have to recover the research and development costs to make the product, but they don't have any costs for getting it approved. They penciled that out and said, okay, this works. This seems to work for us as a business model.
How does your work help conventional breeding, or does it?
It does. So we spend a lot of time figuring out how plants grow, how genes affect how plants grow. And for example, we study growth promoting hormones in my lab, or these plant steroids called brassinosteroids. And there are other hormones that are also growth promoting, like the gibberellins. And in the case of the gibberellins, the semi-dwarf high-yielding wheat that is grown all around here are mutations in that pathway. People recognized what that pathway does by using lots of different genetic tools, including transgenics, to figure out how gibberellins affect plant growth and development, not only plant stature, but also seed germination and dormancy and pre-harvest sprouting and low falling numbers. And all of that is us figuring out, how does this hormone affect all these different processes? And with that knowledge, then we can help tailor breeding programs, traditional breeding programs, to utilize mutations in particular genes. So those could be genes that are involved in day length and flowering time, in stature, in root growth. There's a lot of fundamental work that's being done here and elsewhere on nitrogen fixation in legumes. And even if you're not going to use that technology to make a transgenic plant, you can learn which genes are important to select for in order to increase nitrogen fixation or increase yield or change stature. So all of this fundamental work has the potential to have an impact on breeding. I'd also like to point out that sometimes when we're doing this fundamental work, we don't know, in fact, often, we don't know what the impact will be. Each case, we have to look at all the tools that we have and then come up with the best way to target a particular trait.
As a scientist who is looking at and using all of these technologies, do you see a difference between them? I mean, do you see a difference between transgenics, between CRISPR-Cas9, between TALENs, are they all the same and we as human beings are simply making the differences?
Now, that is a great question. Okay, so I see these all as different. And to actually get into why requires, some fairly detailed scientific knowledge. I teach a graduate level course on plant molecular genetics, and we talk about all this over an entire semester so that by the end of that semester, the students understand the similarities and differences and the powers of these different tools. So one example where these techniques are very different and where I get extremely excited about genome editing, and that is if I want to target 3, 4, 5 genes at once, I can do that with one transgene that expresses a targeting RNA for each of those 5 genes. And I can go in just a couple of months, knock out the expression of an entire pathway. Now, if I was going to do that by the traditional transgenic approach, I would either need to disrupt each of those 5 genes by getting lucky enough to drop a transgene into the middle of each of those genes and disrupt each of them individually. It's something we do in Arabidopsis a lot. And then I would have to do essentially traditional breeding. So we're just talking now about figuring out how plants work. And I would have to cross and cross and cross and make a double mutant and then a triple mutant and then a quadruple mutant and then a quintuple mutant. And that could take me years. Or I can make that quintuple mutant in 2 months using gene editing. And that's what we're doing in the lab. So when gene editing came out, I got so excited because it allowed me to do an experiment that I won't otherwise be able to do in my career or my lifetime. I mean, there's 9 genes that I want to knock out in one pathway. And I've got an undergrad who's now going to be a master's student who's working on that. We've knocked out 4 of those 9. And we could knock out the other 5 next semester. That's amazing. So for actually accelerating our ability to understand how organisms work, gene editing is a complete game changer. And that's why people here are doing this in animals and insects and bacteria and plants, because all of us molecular geneticists are realizing, oh my goodness, this is phenomenal. We can do things we could never do before.
Did you hear that? We can do things we could never do before. Of course, that's the role of science, isn't it? Big questions are asked, and over a period of time, answered again and again and again. As Neff explained earlier, the progress started with a Catholic monk's curiosity about peas in the mid-1800s. That same spirit of inquiry continues to fuel scientific discoveries today. The next time you hear someone badmouth basic research because it doesn't deliver anything of value to farmers, remember CRISPR-Cas9's gene editing capabilities. Scientists are only at the beginning of discovering what this technology is capable of, but I'm pretty sure I'm not exaggerating when I say we ain't seen nothing yet. That's it for episode 21 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling There's Nothing Basic About It. Hope you've enjoyed the show. I see a lot of you have signed up for the podcast via a subscription service available on iTunes. There's no cost to a subscription, although a credit card is required as part of creating an account. I know how forgetful I am. Keep it simple. Subscribe. Search on iTunes for Weed All About It!
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chillin'. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.